Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 19th of June, these are our main stories. The five Conservative men seeking to replace Theresa May as British Prime Minister have clashed in a noisy television debate. The acting US Defence Secretary, Patrick Shanahan, has withdrawn from consideration for the job amid reports of a history of family violence. Also in this podcast, as ethnic violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo forces hundreds of thousands to flee to Uganda, there are fears this could hamper efforts to contain the spread of Ebola.
More than 300,000 people now fleeing within the last 2 weeks. More people could be forced to flee across Lake Albert or into Uganda.
And a starving and exhausted polar bear strays into a major industrial center in northern Siberia, hundreds of kilometers from its natural habitat. The internal contest to choose a new leader of the governing British Conservative Party and to become Prime Minister-elect has taken an important step forward, with the 313 Conservative Party MPs voting for a second time. The current runaway favourite is the former Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, but four other candidates remain in the race. Those remaining five contenders outlined their policies in a televised debate hosted by the BBC. Addressing the Brexit question head-on, Mr. Johnson said politicians would pay a really serious price if the UK failed to leave the EU by the 31st of October.
I think the British people are getting thoroughly fed up. Whether you voted Remain or Leave, the people were asked a question. They returned a verdict. The politicians said that they were going to honour that verdict. 3 years later, we have still failed to leave.
And the one candidate ruling out a no-deal exit, Rory Stewart, argued it was impossible to negotiate a new deal by the October deadline, leaving the existing withdrawal agreement as the only way out of the EU, an idea challenged by another candidate, Michael Gove.
In the end, we are in a room with a door, and the door is called Parliament. And I'm the only person here trying to find the key to the door. Everybody else is staring at the wall, shouting, "Believe in Britain."
We've run into that door three times already, Rory. But we've got to have a different route out.
I asked our British Affairs correspondent, Rob Watson, how he assessed the TV debate.
It was difficult to watch. It was a noisy, messy affair with five candidates talking over each other. I guess the big takeaway from it is that there was no headline. I mean, it seems to me there was no obvious winner, no obvious loser. There was no knockout punch. There was no absolutely terrible gaffe. And neither were there any incredibly memorable lines. And I guess on the big issue of Brexit, I think anyone hoping that somehow they would know more about how these candidates, who all said Brexit needed to be delivered sooner rather than later, how they would succeed where Theresa May had failed, I think the detail simply wasn't there.
But there was only one of the candidates who was willing to say that he would take no deal off the table, so to speak.
Yes, Rory Stewart, the International Development Secretary, stands out from the others in that he's not promising, as they are, to somehow renegotiate a better deal with the European Union. He says that's not possible. And neither will he, like the others, say, look, if it really came down to it and I had to choose between no deal or no Brexit, Rory Stewart won't go for no deal. I mean, the problem that he has with that, of course, is that the Conservative Party membership, activists who have the ultimate final say in who becomes Prime Minister, I mean, they are all pretty gung-ho for Brexit, so he's the wrong man for that crowd.
All eyes would have also been, obviously, on Boris Johnson. He's by far the front-runner, the former Foreign Secretary and Brexit campaigner. How did he do?
You would have never guessed, I don't think, from that performance that he was the front runner. I mean, he was just sort of one in the crowd. I think his handlers will be pleased that nothing went particularly disastrously wrong, but neither did he hit the ball out of the park. And that's why I kind of returned to where we started. I mean, nobody really emerged as the absolute winner, whether Boris Johnson or anybody else, and no one emerged as a sort of disastrous loser either.
And what happens next?
So what happens next is that the Conservative Party MPs whittle it down to just two by the end of Thursday. And then there's another month where they fight it out with 120,000 or so activists of the Conservative Party. And we should know, we will have a new Prime Minister. And at this stage, I think it has to be a Prime Minister, Johnson, in the week beginning July 22nd. So you can stick that in your calendars.
Okay, we will. Rob Watson. The United States government has once again been left without a defense secretary because acting secretary Patrick Shanahan has pulled out of his confirmation process. President Trump tweeted that Mr. Shanahan had done a wonderful job and could now devote more time to his family. However, the development comes amid reports of a troubling history of family violence, as our Washington correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher told me.
Mr. Shanahan has put out his own statement since, in which he said that as part of the confirmation process, a very painful family event had been dredged up from years ago and had been painted in an incomplete and misleading way. And therefore, it was forcing his children to relive a very traumatic event. And he didn't want to put them through that. And so in their interest, he was resigning. Now, he didn't mention the event, but according to media reports here, the FBI had been looking into a violent domestic dispute with his then wife 9 years ago. There were other family incidents as well that were quite troubling that Mr. Shanahan had been involved with, not him personally, but his children and so on.
Presumably, this was part of an effort by the Trump administration to get one of their many acting officials confirmed. So where do they go from here?
Yes, and the Department of Defense as well, which is an important position. And that department has been without a confirmed secretary for 6 months. Remember, James Mattis, the former defense secretary, resigned in December because of policy differences with the president. It's the longest time that a crucial department like this has been without a confirmed leader. Mr. Trump has already mentioned a name. He said that the Secretary of the Army, Mark Esper, will fill in. So it is going to be a military man. Mr. Shanahan, of course, was not. He was a Boeing executive.
And how will Patrick Shanahan, who, as you said, came from the business sector, be remembered in the Defense Department?
Yeah, he was an interesting appointment. There were quite a number of critics who said, for example, that he had less independence from the White House, that he was a bit of a pushover. He'd ceded too much authority to the White House, especially to the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, and questions about whether there was a conflict of interest because of his Boeing background. But there were others who said that, in fact, he was a sort of calm, no-drama leader, that he was learning on the job, but he had been working to shore up national security alliances, and under the circumstances that he was probably the best choice. So I think there will be mixed reviews.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington. Natural resources in Colombia, the second most biodiverse country in the world, are under threat. Deforestation has rocketed since the 2016 peace deal between the government and the left-wing FARC guerrillas, which ended more than 50 years of conflict. A new initiative, however, is bringing together ex-combatants and the local community for training to protect the forest. The BBC's Sophie Eastall has been in the department of Meta, one of the worst affected regions.
The sun has just come up in the small settlement of La Pista. Around 100 former members of the FARC are living here with their families. Like much of Colombia, this area, a natural reserve next to the Tanigua National Park, has seen a huge increase in deforestation since the rebels gave up their arms. Albedo Suarez was a guerrilla fighter for 27 years. Now he's leading the local effort on conservation. He's taking me down a steep, muddy path to an area where he and local villagers look out for illegal logging.
Here, the state has not helped us with any logistics to support forest monitoring. So what we do? A group of four or five community leaders get together, decide on an area and say, let's go and look. If people in a neighborhood tip us off about deforestation, we will go over to investigate. Last year, we told the local authorities and the army about deforestation. The army did come and arrest the farmers who were cutting down trees. But the person who was actually behind it, they let him go.
An hour's drive from the settlement, at a model farm overlooking the valley, a group of students in a blue military-style uniform is getting a lesson on land management. A row of tents flanks the open-air classroom as the farmers and ex-combatants come from the surrounding areas to stay. With the help of the UK and Norway, the project aims to train around 3,000 people. Dairen Murillo is a programme leader. Her son was murdered during the conflict. She tells me the scheme is helping people move forward.
I'm sure that local farmers and former guerrillas working together is what we need. It's been a beautiful experience. When the FARC were here, they controlled a lot of the mountains. And since they left, we have seen a lot of deforestation. Together, I know we are going to be able to slow it down because the ex-combatants have the knowledge of the forests.
The rural region of Meta, where I am, is a food basket for Colombia. It was a heartland of the FARC. After they demobilized, their absence created an opportunity for illegal logging. We spot a couple using machetes to clear the land. For migrant farmers like Guillermo Ramirez, this is the only way to survive.
We are farmers. We need to cut down trees to grow the things that we consume every day. Coffee, beans, yuca, bananas, corns, and all that. We need some land to work on.
While farmers are often the first frontier of deforestation, we were told many of them are paid by landowners. Land grabbing has become rife since the conflict ended, with criminal gangs and dissident rebel groups racing to get in on the act. Back at the settlement of La Pista, Albero is meeting villagers to discuss sustainable cattle farming. He has made an agreement with farmers to stop cutting trees, but he is adamant that if the government doesn't offer alternatives in the next 2 years, people will go back to felling the forest for illicit crops like coca.
Sophie Eastall in Colombia. Still to come in this podcast.
This song is called Angura. Angura in Arabic means light it up, basically, let it burn.
The artists backing the resistance in Sudan. The BBC has found new evidence of the increasing control and suppression of Islam in China's far western region of Xinjiang, including the widespread destruction of mosques. The Chinese authorities say they're trying to combat violent Islamic extremism, but as our China correspondent John Sudworth reports, some of their policies appear to target religious belief itself.
At the Idkar Mosque, Xinjiang's biggest, a few old men gather in silence just before prayers. I ask the government-approved imam, my matey Juma, why so few have come.
It's true that a few years ago there were more people, but nowadays the government is creating jobs. People are busy making money. So naturally, fewer people come to pray.
The classrooms, full of Xinjiang's Muslims, the Uyghurs, the Kazakhs and other minorities, tell a different story. Over the past few years, hundreds of thousands have disappeared into giant secure facilities designed, China says, to transform their extremist thoughts. And satellite photos show that across this vast desert region, dozens of mosques have been destroyed, their distinctive domes visible one day, gone the next. China is trying to convince the world that its policies are a proportional response to the threat of violent Islamic extremism in Xinjiang. But with religious sites either destroyed, closed or deserted, it's clear Islam is in retreat. At the Idkar Mosque, once the vibrant heart of a deeply devout society, we listen as just one lone voice prays quietly.
John Sudworth reporting. Ethnic violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo has left at least 160 people dead, and hundreds of thousands have fled their homes. There are concerns that the conflict between Hema herders and Lendu farmers will affect attempts to control the current Ebola outbreak in the region. And as a spokesperson for the UN's refugee agency, Babar Baloch, said, there were fears the violence could trigger a big movement of people across the border into Uganda.
As the displacement continues at this massive scale, fears are more people will try to seek safety in Uganda. So far, the numbers that we have seen are really small, but it could pick up with around or more than 300,000 people now fleeing within the last 2 weeks. More people could be forced to flee across Lake Albert or into Uganda.
Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, has more.
It seems that this recent surge of violence was provoked by the killing of about four members of the Lendu ethnic group, which then provoked a massive revenge attack by members of the Lendu on the Hema people. And it really seems to have been a particularly devastating attack, with at least 160 people killed, eyewitnesses talking about people being burned in their houses or killed with machetes. And the problem is that it's led to this massive displacement of people. The governor of Ituri province, which is where it happened, said it might be as many as 400,000 people being displaced. One group are farmers and the other group are nomads. And so they often compete for grazing rights, for access to land. And then they also, because there's been this cycle of violence between them, there's also this pattern of revenge killings that take place.
And there's also a fear that this may have a knock-on effect on the efforts to control Ebola in the region.
Yeah, it's a real problem because where this violence has taken place and this mass displacement of people, hundreds of thousands of people, the fear is that that's going to make it difficult to control the Ebola outbreak, because if people are moving around, you can't look after them so well. There's also a fear that they might cross over the border into neighbouring Uganda, which has already had a problem with two people dying there who just recently arrived from Congo. So health officials are very worried that this is going to make life even more difficult for them in an already very, very difficult and precarious situation.
So we heard there from a UN official saying they were concerned about the situation in the DRC, but is the international community doing anything to improve things?
It's a strange thing, because in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you've got the world's largest peacekeeping or intervention force, or whatever you want to label it, under the auspices of the United Nations. And they seem unable to contain violence in eastern Congo. There's so many different militias and then other forms of violence like this one that's more to do with inter-ethnic hatred. So they obviously need a lot of international assistance. But whether that's going to be forthcoming is another question.
Mary Harper. Protests in Sudan have subsided since June the 3rd, when a pro-democracy sit-in was broken up by the military. The authorities have shut down the internet to stop the protesters from mobilizing. But does this mean the revolution is over? The BBC went to meet some young musicians to hear about their experiences. The BBC's Tommy Oladipo reports from the Sudanese capital.
It's late night in Khartoum, and I've come to a recording studio to meet a collective, a group of hip-hop artists who've lent their voices to the resistance.
And what?
The first day, that was the most surprising.
Yeah, nobody thought that people would stay
nobody
after 10.
Nobody expected it.
Nobody expected that you'll be sitting there for a whole month,
nobody
right?
Nobody expected the numbers.
Yeah. So my name is Mahdi Ali Mahdi, a.k.a. Mamed. I'm a Sudanese artist. This song is called Angura. Angura in Arabic means light it up, basically. Let it burn, and let it all fall, if you know what I mean. The revolution sounds is what inspires us to write this music, and we just take their words and put it into melodies and try to show it out to the world.
Now that there has been this shutdown of the internet, because that was one of the ways people mobilized, but it's also a way of you getting your songs out, how has that hit you now?
the sound of the revolution is in the street with the people. It doesn't even need the internet. There's so many other means that people know about. Yeah, you know, we were living during 2000 and 2001. We were living without phones and internet for that time, and we were sharing whatever we wanted to share.
How are you going to do that, practically?
Just mainly by word of mouth. I need to be out there more around with the people now. You know, we had the comfort of being behind the desks most of the time with the internet or behind our phones. But now is the real time, I think, that people should be face-to-face. You know what I mean? Talking face-to-face, discussing what we should do and being able to get there.
As you do this, I'm getting the sense that you're not particularly affiliated to any political party, for example. Where is this coming from? Where is this whole resistance coming from?
I classify myself as an artist that has a message and there's a purpose for this message. I'm not a political person, but politics guides us and rules our life on a daily basis. So what I hope that politics in Sudan, where it will grow into a full democracy, what I hope for our children, because I have a child, that they will not find another dictators after 30 years and try to do what we do.
That report by Tommy Oladipo. A starving and exhausted polar bear has strayed hundreds of kilometers from its natural habitat and wandered into Norilsk, a major industrial center in northern Siberia. It's thought to be the first polar bear sighting in the world's northernmost city in more than four decades. More details from Sasha Schlichter.
According to one environment official, the bear was roaming around a factory under observation by the emergency services. It's believed she is ill and weak. A local wildlife expert who filmed the animal close up said it was unclear what had brought her to Norilsk, although it was possible she had simply got lost. He said she had watery eyes and could clearly not see well. A team of experts is due to arrive on Wednesday to inspect the bear and decide her fate. Climate change has been damaging the polar bear's habitats, forcing them to scavenge for food on land and bringing them into greater contact with humans. In February, a state of emergency was declared after dozens of polar bears approached a village in the far northern Novaya Zemlya archipelago, with several exploring streets and buildings.
Sasha Schlichter. And before we go, here's an update on a major World Service podcast investigating an unsolved murder mystery that dates back nearly 50 years.
An unidentified body in a remote Norwegian valley.
She was laying with her head down there.
Who was she?
Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
And what was she doing there?
She has an agenda and she doesn't want to talk about it.
I'm Marit Tegraf.
And I'm Neil McCarthy. And in Death in Ice Valley, we tried to find answers to a mystery that has remained unsolved for 48 years.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
Tracking down eyewitnesses and using new forensic technology.
Now I'm cutting the tooth.
Telling a story set deep in the Cold War with strong hints of espionage.
If you take the missile, I will shoot.
But it left us with a lingering feeling that someone didn't want the truth to be known.
Obviously, he was told by some people to keep his mouth shut.
We're about to come back with an update, so now's the perfect time to catch up with the whole series.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
What on earth happened that day?
That's Death in Ice Valley from the BBC World Service and NRK.
I think we'll break this case right now.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.